Okay, well, this is the first ever edition of the Mark D on the Street segment. All right, this is Mark D. I'm here on Main Street in, actually, I'm not sure what city this is. And, well, here comes someone. Hello there, sir. Can I ask you a question? What's your name, by the way? Carl. Okay, Carl, my name is Mark D. Do you know me or maybe recognize my voice? No, why would I? Well, I have a podcast. It's called You Are My Density. Have you heard of it? No, is it any good? Well, not really. Okay, I'll give it a listen. Well, thanks, Carl. All right, well, I consider that a success. On with the show.
You are my density. You are my density.
Speaking of man on the street interviews, I've been coming up with a few more Jack Nicholson-type quotes lately for whatever reason. I find myself saying phrases once every few days that just sound best in a kind of Jack Nicholson style. Okay, here's one. A newscaster is on the street doing interviews with people. He stops a character played by Jack Nicholson and says, "Hello, sir. This is John Humphreys from Channel 7 Live. Can I ask you a question?" And then Jack says, "Oh, this is live? Wow, well, sure." The reporter says, "We've been asking people, how do you deal with the stresses of life?" Jack smiles devilishly. "How do I deal? Well, I drink, I smoke, and I try not to hang myself every night." The reporter says, "Oh, well," and Jack says and looks at the camera, "but I've always got that noose ready to go." The announcer says, "Oh, okay, thank you, and back to you, Phil, for today's sports headlines." Okay, here's a few more. Jack is in a shitty apartment arguing with his wife. This one may be funny in context, but I have no context for it, so it's probably not going to work, but what the hell. So Jack says, "Will you just leave me alone? Get out of here so I can turn on the goddamn air conditioning." Okay, three more. Jack Nicholson looking up to the sky as if to God. "Can't you give me a break? Give me a fucking break, just for once." That one comes directly from my life. This one is kind of good. Okay, a guy at a bar asks Jack Nicholson what his problem is, and he says, "Well, nothing that Alcoholics Anonymous and a good fuck wouldn't cure." And I will save the best for last. I'm sure this line has been used often. I don't recall it in a Jack Nicholson movie per se, but a reporter is speaking with Jack Nicholson, who's playing kind of a legendary mob-type hoodlum character, and the reporter says, "How would you describe your life?" And Jack says, "How would I describe my life? Criminally underrated." Okay, that's it for this week's edition of Stuff That Sounds Like Jack Nicholson Would Say. So at the psych hospital, we're supposed to check if someone is oriented. So like, you know, oriented to the time, the place, self, and situation. And, you know, I don't often ask patients what day of the week it is or the date, because to be honest, I kind of don't keep track. I mean, my work days always fluctuate. I live by myself. I kind of have no life here in Sunnyvale. So to be honest, I mean, I always do know what day of the week it is if I'm asked, but sometimes I'm just like, shit, what is today? And I have to think about it. And the date to me right now is irrelevant. I'm still struggling a bit. And I said to my mom the other day, "This too shall pass." And you know things aren't going so great when you use that fucking term. And it was kind of bittersweet. Last week at work, I was talking to a couple of older patients, like 80-something-year-old dudes. I love bullshitting with older guys. One of them was talking about something about younger people, and I was like, "Well, anyone under 30 is a fucking idiot." But I had mentioned that I was applying to jobs in Los Angeles, and this one guy, this one patient, lovable older guy that I kind of connected with, like an accomplished guy, too. He was a retired scientist. But he was like, "Let us know if we can write a letter of recommendation or anything." And I just kind of smiled, and what a sweet goddamn real moment. And to myself, I was like, well, I do have letters of recommendations from doctors and nurses. Shit, maybe I should start putting letters in from, you know, actual patients. And actually, for a psych nurse position, and I'm being 100% honest here, letters from patients would shed more insight than your usual recommendation letter. I mean, recommendation letters generally are so pro forma, just like generic shit. Though I did get a letter of recommendation from a buddy doctor I worked for in Los Angeles. It was like specific for me. He put details in there. And I was like, dude, you just fucking nailed it. And there was another Jack Nicholson type quote I literally said at work this week. I had an admit, like a new patient came in. So I interviewed them, you know, and I did all the necessary paperwork and shit, and I got it out. I got it done quickly. And so a little bit later, one of the nursing assistants was like, oh, let me have that, you know, the new patient fill out the menu for tomorrow's meals. And I just looked at her and I said that I've already done that. And then I said, I'm very fucking good at this. And it was just perfect. And you know what? I am good at my job. I mean, in a way, my entire life has led me to be a psych nurse and to do this podcast. I mean, it's like I've been trying to be empathetic, talking to people, connecting, bullshitting my whole life. So it all kind of makes sense. Whoa, man, it's kind of trippy. So yeah, I'm pretty damn good at my job. But unfortunately, the job is also destroying me. C'est la vie. Okay, another edition of people that fucking annoy me. Anyone at the grocery store who is like, oh, can I do those two other things on a separate order? And I'm like, you fucking sleazebag. Just fucking pay for the whole thing at once. Look, here's $20. Just get the fuck out of here. And this one really fumes me. When some fucker has a million things in their cart, I'm sitting behind them after work, generally with my nurse uniform and psych badge on. I look fucking haggard. And I'm buying one bottle of wine. And they don't let me get in front of them. Which is just the courteous way to go. It's just a rule. Like, that would almost determine if a person I was getting to know is solid enough. It's to see if they're the type of person that has obvious manners and just class. So yeah, I get totally pissed. It's taking forever for them to scan all of this person's items. Inevitably, this sloth also isn't packing their own bags or helping, and I usually just can't help myself. I have to say something under my breath, possibly within earshot. I usually say something like, you fucking hog. Okay, last thing. When, like, able-bodied people don't bag their own groceries, it's like there's no bag boy or bag girl or whatever. You've got a bunch of shit that you're buying, so get off your ass and start bagging. What is bagging beneath you, you elitist fuck? The cashier is working hard. Fuck you. Bag your own groceries, you lazy, stupid son of a bitch. Jesus, where were we? Were we just talking about charcuterie boards? No? Well, shit, where did that come from? Briefly, as mentioned many episodes ago, I have a tendency to throw away my mouth night guard. I mean, what, a laid-back, breezy guy like me clenches his teeth at night? You're surprised? Hell, I clench my teeth during the day, too. But yes, if you can believe it or not, I again threw away my night guard in the trash last week. It seems to always happen on days I'm driving to visit my mom. I'm up early, and for some reason, I just walk to the kitchen and take this thing out of my mouth, and my brain just thinks, oh, this is disposable, and I throw it in the trash. And when I got to my mom's, I was unpacking, and I literally said out loud, oh, God damn it, I think I threw away my fucking night guard again. I think I'm swearing a lot in this episode, but I mean, it just has to be fucking night guard. So this is literally like the fourth, literally, goddammit. So this is literally like the fourth night guard I've thrown away. I mean, I just bought a new one less than a year ago for like $400. I mean, at this point, this is beyond stupid. I mean, this is imbecilic, like dumb and dumber level shit. So I don't know, man. Next time I get new insurance, I will get a night guard. But for now, I grind on. And speaking of Dumb and Dumber, the 1994 Peter Farrelly directed film with Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels as our two idiot lead characters and Lauren Holly as the female love and interest. God, I always have had a thing for Lauren Holly completely. Whoosh. But there's a funny scene where Jim Carrey's idiot character Lloyd is speaking with Lauren Holly. He says, what do you think the chances are of a guy like you and a girl like me ending up together? I mean, that's kind of a well-done line, actually. The fact that this guy is so stupid that he's saying a guy like you and a girl like me and not realizing it is kind of genius. But anyway, after he asks what his chances are, and she says, not good. He says, you mean like not good, like 1 out of 100? And she says, I'd say more like 1 out of 1,000,000. And he smiles, you know, widely and says, so you're telling me there's a chance? Pretty damn funny, to be honest. Although it would have been funnier if she had said, I'd say more like 1 out of 1 billion or 1 trillion. You know, something totally ridiculous number. speaking of stupid things in my head, I mean, I have a lot of songs I think about on a daily basis that just kind of pop in my mind. But there's one fucker that while I don't hate the song, it almost kind of haunts me. It's like when I always find myself thinking about this song or actually singing it. And this cursed song is the Gypsy Kings' Bamboleo from 1987. So yeah, just kind of out of nowhere, occasionally I will be visited by the refrain, Bamboleo, Bambolea, porque mi vida yo cook me cerca vida aquí. I don't know the Spanish part on that, but it's just that meaning that Bamboleo part. I can't be the only one afflicted by this condition. And if you too are suffering from this, contact me now and let's try to sue someone. PBSD, Post Bamboleo Stress Disorder. It's a real fucking thing. Okay, where are you going with this? Okay, well, forget bird flu, America. Now what we have is panda fever. Pandemonium. Pandalopolis. The unwanted sequel to Francis Ford Coppola's Megalopolis, which 10 people went to see in the movie theaters. Me and 9 members of Francis Ford Coppola's family. Well, the 2 giant pandas are back at the Smithsonian National Zoo in Washington, D.C., dude, pandas just crack me up. They walk around all lazily and fucking eat all the time, sitting on their asses. And pandas are kind of one of the only animals that kind of actually look like a person just wearing an ill-fitted panda costume. It's like the way their flesh is. It just kind of looks like it's a goddamn costume. But yeah, I picture like someone like Chris Farley or something sitting in a costume whenever I see pandas. And the Smithsonian Zoo has a panda cam on the internet. You can click on there. There's like a live camera feeds and maybe see one of the 2 pandas, or you may not see anything. I checked it out a few times, and one time I saw one of the pandas, and guess what they were doing? Yeah, they were sitting and fucking eating. And briefly on the history of panda diplomacy, it kind of began in the 1950s when China's leader Mao Zedong, Chairman Mao Zedong, debit, started giving pandas to its socialist allies. Me, I would rather be given money. But hey, a panda works. Could probably sell it. It certainly stands out. But yeah, when Nixon visited China in 1972, some of our tensions with China were starting to thaw a little bit, so 2 pandas were gifted to the United States around that time. So there you go, a little history lesson. I consider my podcast to be edutainment. Yes, a mixture of education and entertainment. God, I always hated when people use that term, edutainment. And speaking of some Cold War-related news, the Doomsday Clock was recently set to 89 seconds to midnight. This Doomsday Clock was made by some Manhattan Project scientists, kind of gauging like how close we are to destruction or nuclear devastation. Geez, what a cheerful-sounding group of people. I wouldn't want to go to their dinner parties. But yeah, back when it was originally set in 1947, it was like 7 minutes to midnight. It gets moved backward and forward. I guess the furthest time from midnight it's been is 17 minutes in 1991. And the nearest to midnight is, yes, our current number, 89 seconds. 89 seconds to midnight sounds like a Liam Neeson movie. Anyway, I do agree that we are definitely at our closest doom level yet, the way this world is going. But the idea of the clock is just kind of silly. I mean, I know it's a metaphor, but it generally means like nothing to people. No one is like, oh shit, now it's 89 seconds to midnight on the doomsday clock. Okay, I'm going to change my act and clean up. But anyway, I do appreciate the metaphor. So last week I mentioned the enjoyable low-budget horror film Boneface. Well, I'll be goddamned, I ran across another well-shot, clever little horror comedy. It's called Bloody Axe Wound, and it's from 2024. It's kind of a slasher comedy. It revolves around a female character whose, get this, father is an undead serial killer who runs a video store, and she's going to inherit his business. And the business actually is selling videos made up of videotapes of the killings by the killer himself, I guess. And oh yeah, I forgot to mention, the plot kind of fucking makes no sense. It's like, who's doing the filming of the killing from like the POV of the killer and the different angles and stuff on the videotapes? But trust me, it's kind of fun. It's well-acted, likable characters. It's got a fun, silly energy, some gore. But again, I just found it pretty enjoyable. And again, if you love horror movies, you will find something to like in it. Plot be damned. And by the way, Plot be damned would be an excellent name for an autobiography or a movie or maybe even a band. Plot be damned. God damn, that's good. Oh, and damn it, I literally just thought of another Jack Nicholson quote. So Jack is standing next to his goofball friend, let's say Elliot Gould. Elliot Gould is pointing to something and says, You see, man, that's art. And Jack says, you wouldn't know art if it came up and bit you on your ass. Not too bad, right? Anywho, don't you hate that word? Anywho. But anywho, so I rarely watch true crime documentaries, aside from the recently mentioned JonBenet documentary on Netflix, but I saw there was a new documentary on Netflix on the O.J. Simpson trial called American Manhunt, O.J. Simpson, and it just sounded so up my alley. I looked up the derivation of the phrase up my alley, and it was kind of lame. It was kind of referring to being of one's own province. But anyway, I mean, O.J. and the murders and the trial was just like absolute seminal, like as big as you can get. It completely swept the nation. I mean, it had Hollywood, celebrity, madness, just a legendary cast of characters. And I mean, I used to live off of Bundy Drive where Nicole Simpson was killed by O.J., of course. I actually went to a party like three or four houses down from where she was killed. This was like, I don't know, 4 or 5 months before she got killed. And I remember like a couple days after she got killed, I was driving by her house, showing a friend the scene, and all of a sudden some police sirens behind me went off. The press and all the people at the scene looked over at me, and I was like, oh shit, are they arresting me for her murder? But the cop was pulling me over because I wasn't wearing a seatbelt. But anyway, back to the documentary, man, I loved it. I mean, the first episode was focused solely on the evidence found at the crime scene and at O.J. Simpson's Rockingham estate. I mean, yes, the investigation was kind of flawed. The problem was there was like too much evidence. And from this first episode, you see a bunch of other evidence that for some reason the prosecution didn't use in the trial. Like, I guess they found an empty knife box in O.J.'s bedroom. And likely O.J. threw away the knife he probably used at the airport. Someone at the airport witnessed O.J. throwing something away from a duffel bag, but he wasn't so called as a witness. But yes, the big fly in the ointment was the racist detective Mark Furman. I mean, he was only briefly on the case at the beginning, but the defense team was able to unfortunately and successfully turn the case from the story of a confirmed wife beater to a story about race. I mean, Nicole Simpson herself reportedly told a policeman, I know he's going to murder me someday. But yeah, I mean, the amount of blood evidence was insane. There was one left-hand glove left at the scene, just one, that cops saw before Mark Furman even got to the scene. And one right-hand pair at O.J. Simpson's estate behind one of the bungalows that Cato Kalin rented from O.J. I won't get into exhaustive detail, but just a few key facts. So O.J. was to be picked up at his Rockingham estate to go to the airport that night. Earlier in the day, O.J. went to him and Nicole Kidd's ballet recital, and Nicole went too, but O.J. wasn't invited to dinner afterwards. And Nicole and her mom, and I think the kids, they went to the now-closed Mezzaluna restaurant, where Ron Goldman, the other victim of O.J., worked. So in the timeline, the murders occurred between maybe 10:15 and 10:45. Cato Kalin saw O.J. at the residence on Rockingham wearing a dark sweatsuit around 9:30. And after that, O.J.'s Bronco was not at the house. A neighbor saw the Bronco was gone, and this limo driver arrived and started buzzing the intercom to try and get O.J. around 10:40 for a while. No one answered. The limo driver also noted O.J.'s Ford Bronco not being there on the street. So O.J. was somewhere during this time, wearing a dark sweatsuit while Nicole and Ron Goldman were being killed. So if you don't believe O.J. Simpson was at the crime scene, well, there was the bloody left-hand glove there, size XL Aris Light, which Nicole bought for O.J. in 1990 at Bloomingdale's. Oh, and there was a trail of blood from the dead bodies from the scene of the crime to the back gate, and the trail of blood, which is consistent with someone with an injury on the left side. O.J. Simpson had fresh cuts on his left hand and knuckle after they had arrested him. He had no real explanation for the injury. He said maybe golfing or he broke a glass or something. Okay, so let's leave the scene of the crime. A witness literally saw O.J. driving erratically in Brentwood around 10:40. I mean, talk about a key piece of evidence. She wasn't called to testify because she sold her fucking story to the tabloids. And so around 10:40-ish, Cato Kalin hears a few knocks against the back of his room. He's unsure what it was. And at this point, the Ford Bronco is back parked on the street. The limo driver sees a dark figure going into the house. He uses the intercom again, And alas, OJ is now home. OJ goes to the airport, checks his bags, but holds on to his duffel bag, likely filled with evidence, so he throws that away at the airport. So somehow, someone drove OJ's Ford Bronco around the time of Nicole and Ron's death, got OJ's blood all over the scene, got Nicole's blood on a sock found in OJ's bedroom, and got Ron Goldman's blood in OJ's Bronco. Also, I guess someone then drove OJ's Bronco back to the Rockingham estate, and suddenly OJ is home again. So yes, the police were a bit sloppy with their evidence, but did somehow Mark Furman bump into Cato Kalin's room around 10:40 before the police were even involved? And that's, he planted the glove there? Cato told Detective Furman he heard a bump behind the room. Furman went back there and found a glove. Yes, the right-hand glove matching the other glove at the scene. Several cops only saw one glove at the crime scene before Furman ever even knew about it or went to the scene. But somehow he took a glove that no one saw, and then when Cato mentions hearing a bump behind the residence, Furman thinks, oh, it's my opportunity to plant this bloody glove I have here in my pocket. I mean, come on, guys. And basically, without Mark Furman, OJ's defense would have been screwed. They turned OJ into a symbol of black oppression, which I totally get, man. I mean, America has treated African Americans terribly. And yes, the fuckers that beat up Rodney King were guilty as shit. But to get their revenge with this Hollywood celebrity wife beater is just so unfortunate. OJ may have grown up in the projects in San Francisco, but as an adult, he was straight out of Brentwood. Also, a couple other quick thoughts. When they called OJ in Chicago telling him his wife was dead, he didn't ask what happened. He didn't ask for details, and that's fucking abnormal. What else on the fucking gloves? If the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit bullshit. Well, the gloves had been wet from blood and frozen and then thawed, and I guess that can shrink gloves up to 15%. And OJ was wearing latex gloves, and his remarkably hammy performance putting the other gloves on was like naked gun level bad. It's like, just put them on. Stop acting silly. And yes, the prosecution made a big-time error by having OJ put on the gloves, but in the end, they actually did kind of fit. Seeing him and his histrionics were laughable. OJ was always a terrible actor, and man, it showed. OJ's glove antics reminded me of the line from William Shakespeare's Hamlet, "The lady doth protest too much, methinks." I mean, methinks, how fucking good is that? Which kind of means that someone is trying so hard to deny something that they're actually obviously hiding the truth. One person that came out of this whole OJ mess with some dignity was his friend Ron Shipp, an ex-police officer who went to see OJ after Nicole's death. Ron knew OJ had been abusive to Nicole, and Ron Shipp was really hung up on OJ's hand injury. He asked OJ how he cut his hand, and he could tell OJ was bullshitting him. And Ron Shipp knew OJ was guilty. And it kind of broke Ron Shipp's heart. So yes, OJ was found not guilty by reason of stupidity by the jury. He eventually was found guilty on civil charges, which requires a lower bar of evidence. And they were also able to introduce the bloody shoe print from the crime scene, which was a size 12 Bruno Magli Italian shoe, which was a rarely sold shoe, quite expensive. And oh yeah, OJ Simpson had that exact pair, that exact size and shoe. They had like a big photo of him doing football commentary wearing the fucking shoes years before the murder. How did they plant that there, guys? So yeah, OJ was found guilty, but not in the criminal case. So there was justice only partially served. OJ ended up serving prison time for some memorabilia, hoodlum-level shit, hotel shit in Las Vegas. But effectively, after the murder trials were finished, OJ was a pariah, a joke, a ghost of himself forever, failingly trying to reignite his celebrity status with failed TV shows or publicity stunts. He lived most of the remainder of his life in Florida, surviving off the embers of his fame with some pathetic groupies, eventually dying of cancer. And I hope every day of his life he heard someone yell, "You murderer," at him. And while Nicole Simpson, of course, didn't deserve to be beaten or killed by OJ, she did get married to the son of a bitch. And I want to briefly mention Ronald Goldman, who just sounded like a decent guy, really just starting his life. I mean, he was only 25 years old, an aspiring actor living in Brentwood on Gorham Avenue and working at the restaurant in Brentwood named Mezzaluna. Mezzaluna later became my favorite, Pete's Coffee, and was across the street from the newsstand that I used to go to every damn morning. This is the same Pete's where I saw Mike Tyson, who seemed scary, and the actor Bill Pullman, who just had a fucking charisma about him. Alas, that Pete's and the newsstand are both closed now. But anyway, Ron Goldman just sounded like a nice guy trying to find his place in the world, having fun, just being a young guy in Los Angeles. I guess that final night when Nicole and the kids and Nicole's mom ate at Mezzaluna, Nicole's mom left her glasses at the restaurant. Ronald said he would drop the glasses off at Nicole's after work. So he put the glasses in an envelope and drove over to Nicole's house around that fateful time, around 10:30. And he wasn't sleeping with her or anything, at least not that night. When they found the bodies, the envelope with the glasses was still sitting there at the crime scene, so he didn't go into her house that night. And who knows how it went down, but the theory is that OJ was attacking Nicole. Ron came up and tried to help her and defend himself, and he went down fighting. So I also always felt for the poor Goldman family. I mean, they were a fixture at the trial. I mean, they made sure someone was there every day representing Ron. And the shameful defense team for OJ implied that maybe the deaths were due to some kind of drug dealing, kind of sullying Ron Goldman in the process. I mean, I know so many defense lawyers are the scum of the earth, but don't you guys have some limits? I mean, is there no bottom? So OJ, Johnny Cochran, Robert Kardashian, you can all rot in hell. Nicole Brown and Ronald Goldman, you are not forgotten. Jesus, sorry I rambled on about that shit, but that documentary just got me going. But yeah, the juice has been squeezed. There's nothing left. So let's close the door on that fucker, and if there's a hell, he's in it. Okay, well, you know, I have no ending for this episode, so let's just end with just the ending of a truly beautiful little song called You Tripped at Every Step by Elvis Costello from the album Brutal Youth from 1994, the same year OJ was arrested. Man, this is just one of my favorite songs. I listen to it weekly. The whole song is great, but the last little section is just so goddamn good. So thank you, Elvis Costello, for bringing a little lightness to the darkness of 1994. In another world of gin and cigarettes, those cocktail cabinets put mud in your eye. Maybe that is why you find it hard to see me. And if you don't believe me, before you start to cry, don't ever leave me. As you tripped at every step, you tripped at every step, you tripped at every step. Oh, how you tripped at every step.